right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Thank you so much for tuning in here today. It's great to have you with us, either if you're tuning in the archives on redice.tv, redicemembers.com, maybe over on BitChute, why not the cursed website, youtube.com, or maybe you're tuning in live because we're doing at least the first part here on dlive.tv/redicetv. So whoever over there joining us, thank you so much for being here live. Today we are going to talk about a new book that's just come out. We have with us Professor Emeritus of Psychology from California State University, Long Beach, Dr. Kevin McDonald, who returns to the show today. It's great to be back, Kevin. How's everything going on your end?
Great to be back with you, Henry, and looking forward to the interview. Things are going well with me. I'm retired. I'm up in a peaceful little area where I have to keep a low profile, and things are going well.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, I mean, you have magnificent work, of course, in your past as well. I have a couple of your titles here, like people should know of The Culture of Critique. I have a copy right here. Do you have some of the Occidental Quarterlies as well? I want to talk more about that a little bit later. And I do not have a hard copy, of course, of the book we're going to dive into today, but I can throw up an image of that because we're going to dive into this here today, ladies and gentlemen. Individualism and the Western Tradition: Evolutionary Origin, History, and the Prospect for the Future. Huge topic, this, obviously. A lot of things in here. The history of this is just a 2-hour show in itself. Tell us how you approached the topic and how long you've been working on this book, Kevin.
Yeah, I've been at this really for 40 years. This was when I started out in my very first academic pursuits. You know, I was an unemployed PhD for a year or two, and for a year, I guess, and I just decided I'm going to start reading anthropology. I was very interested in the evolutionary theory of sex and how it related to other societies. And I was aware that European societies tend towards monogamy. And that is very different from the vast majority of human societies above the most basic subsistence level, hunter-gatherer type societies. Once you get beyond that, wealthy, powerful, important men are able to have more than one wife, usually, and they often have harems, like in the Middle East, the Chinese harems in India, the Muslim world in Africa. As Africa had a much lower level of production, but economic production, but, you know, men would still compete to have extra wives. And they would buy and sell women and that sort of thing. But it did not happen in Europe. And it was a very different thing, but it posed some evolutionary questions. So I started reading European history of marriage and the family, because also I was a developmental psychologist, and history of the family is very important because, children are socialized quite differently in different ages. And God knows kids these days are socialized so different, even from when I was growing up, or probably when you were growing up.
Yeah, definitely.
With all the, smartphones and everything and the internet and able to access pornography when they're, really teenager and that kind of thing. Very different ballgame. But, it's also been different, say, in the 17th century Puritan New England, these other cultures. And so I've been reading family history ever since then. I published a few things on marriage, and that's how I got into it. And I became more aware, I started writing on Jewish issues in the 1990s, but I never gave up this sort of thing up, and
right.
I kept reading on this. And but then after the main work on the three books on Judaism were over, then I turned my attention a lot to this, and I started really sort of building up. But that's almost 20 years ago. So I've been building up gradually. So what you have now is something of a tome. I mean, it's a big, big book, but it covers a lot of topics. And it's probably not easy going for everyone, but I tried to make it navigable. It's a bit very elaborate table of contents, and you can sort of skip around the things you want to take a look at.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot in there. I was going through the book, and of course, I didn't have time to go through all of it before, we brought you on here today. So there's a lot of questions I have for you as well. But really, I guess we could say, for the simplicity's sake, it's broken down kind of like in three parts, and I want to discuss each one of these. And the first one is the, well, maybe not the book in three parts, but three major events like that has led us to the situation that we are today. And as you say, the first one is kind of the Indo-European invasion, sometimes referred to as the Aryan invasion, huge revolution, if you will, in how humans conducted themselves with the advent of these new people. And then, of course, we have the 17th century, so the Puritans, the Protestant Reformation, and then finally the 1960s. So, you know, those are three very interesting things we could look at. But why don't we talk and tell us a little bit about what you see is so significant with the arrival of the Indo-Europeans and what happened when they came in.
Yes, it's extremely important. And it's not just the history of Europe, of course, but the history of much of Eurasia, because they went down south into India, they went over to Western China, Iran, all these areas were conquered by these people. They came out of the steppes, like 2500 BC, around there. And, the steppes in what is now Ukraine, in southwestern Russia, I guess. They were incredibly militarized culture. And by the way, your t-shirt is really, you know, very apropos of this, because you have this, berserker t-shirt on, and this typified the Indo-Europeans, and you say Viking on there. Yeah.
Yeah. Was it the Viking Special Force? It's called it something. I got it from my brother. So thank you for it.
Yeah. The berserkers were soldiers of these Indo-European groups. And when they were in battle, they would just absolutely get frenzied, you know, and almost get into a different mental state. They would actually change they would have this idea that you could change what you were from a human into an animal, like a wolf, and engage in battle like that. This was an incredibly militarized culture. I mean, everything about it, every male was expected to do this. And of course, if they couldn't, they wouldn't have any status. But there was a lot of competition within the society. I describe it as a free market society where there was a lot of upward mobility possible. If you had military talent, if you were a good berserker, if you could, especially if you could lead men into battle, I mean, people would compete for followers, and they would, you know, have these war bands, and these war bands would then go out and essentially try to conquer territory. And when they did, they would, subjugate the people that were there. They would not exterminate them, but they would subjugate them and essentially make them work for the people who conquered them. And, that was their modus operandi. And it's one of the remarkable things that after World War II, this was part of the sort of national socialist zeitgeist about the Aryans and all that. But after World War II, they developed this whole anthropological mythology that these people are just language teachers. They're just, they just were very good at putting their culture out there and getting other people to accept their culture. There was no war involved, you know. But it was just complete mythology. We now know, on the basis of population genetic evidence, these were a real people. And they came up into Europe. They conquered all of Europe. And all of our languages, all of our European languages are Indo-European languages, as is Sanskrit and a variety of other languages around the world. These languages all have common roots on the Pontic steppes in what is now Ukraine. So this was an incredibly successful group. They also had technological advances. They were herding animals. They had very large herds and new technology. They tamed the horse. They enabled them to ride herd and then also to engage in military pursuits. Very elaborate chariots and wagons. Very intelligent people. And they have left their genes around, believe me.
Now, is this I don't want to derail things too much here right away, but of course, as you said, the Aryan invasion was popularized by Maria Gambutas, I think, is one of the scientists that kind of pushed that first. And then, as you say, that was denied or whatever. just because of the association, essentially. And then now it's been proven correct. It's been brought back into the record now with genetics and stuff like that. And they you know, they know that this is the case. They've, of course, used different names now on this, like the Indo-Europeans or whatever. And there is a kind of a proto-culture to this as well, if I do have the timelines right here. They say, if you search for, like, you know, when was the Aryan invasion? What, 1500 BC, something like that. Is a common number that comes up, and I thought, I've heard about the Yamna culture. They've talked a lot about them as well, and I kind of think that must be some kind of proto civilization to this Aryan or Indo-European civilization, and that's back to what the height was. They say here anywhere from 3700 BC to 2500 BC or something like that. What do you know anything about the Yamna? Because they apparently also came with waves into the European continent.
Well, that is the Indo-European.
That is that. Okay, it's the same thing. Okay, yeah, I got you.
I talked about them in chapter one, in the population genetic chapter, because they are, you know, the group that all these Indo-Europeans derived from in different waves. You had a wave that's more, that ended up being the more Germanic, the more Celtic, the more Latin. That ended up with being Roman and Greek and so on. So they came at different times into Europe, and they had slightly different cultures, but there was a commonality there. Centered around this warband culture, centered around males. And, you know, you talk about Marie Gambutis, very interesting. I agree. She has been slighted.
Yes.
I have a long footnote on her in chapter, two, I believe. I think it's a chapter four. On her, where I certainly try to give her credit for this, because she talked about this very, very male oriented, patricentric, culture that invaded Europe, which used to be much more focused, matrilineal, et cetera, than after the invasion. This was a very, male-dominated society in every way, and this is our roots.
And that was a revolution when that happened. And again, that's why. Well, I mean, let's be honest. That's why you don't see any remnants of those. Well, they're returning now. We'll get back to that with this 1960s revolution. Obviously, that's happening as well, which is ironically making us ripe for the same kind of takeover that I'm just going to go on and talk about, which is these matriarchal societies. Yes, there are mythologies and like distant voices that we can hear of these, in the record or whatever. But none of them survived this. None of them survived any of this. They were just ripe for the picking, essentially, for these new people that came in. And so that's why it's so significant and altered and changed, so much with this. So.
Yeah.
I mean, again, there's so much we could discuss here in terms of the significance of this, whatever. But I think it's important to, what you say as well, with this idea that they shared a common root. I mean, essentially, you could see a line from all the way from like Yamna over to, the Scythians later, and those kind of branched off into. They're largely like many of them, or most of them, are like Germanic families. It's the Celtic one. It's even the Frankish one. The Germanic, the Anglos, of course, and then the Nordic kind of branch of that or whatever. But many of them have that common root of this origin point. And despite that, I read a couple of articles, let's see if I can find it here as well. I think it was from, was it Nature, maybe National Geographic, I'm certain, but it was essentially a promotion of multiculturalism by looking at the Yamna culture and say, well, they brought this new exciting food and things were great. It's like, that's essentially what they went through. Yeah. It's like, I mean, the takeover was painful, of course, and it was very violent for those kind of hunter-gatherer people, for example, that was still, in many of these areas. Nonetheless, it was used as a justification for modern multiculturalism and open borders when it's like, that's the reason why we don't want those things, because it's always so traumatic with these huge migration waves that happen. But again, it means that we share a common root, Kevin. So it's actually not the promotion of that, ironically.
That's right. We share a common root. We are related, we share a common gene pool. We are a racial ethnic group.
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. All right. So. What else would you want to say about this period too? I mean, again, I want to move on and talk a little bit about. Let me pull this up here real quick. I do want to talk, of course, about what happened there with the Protestant Revolution and all that stuff, but I don't want to move too far, too fast, too quickly here. So you do have a chapter on population genetics. I mean, that incorporates some of that. Is there any main points from that you'd like to talk about?
Those are the main points. Well, the other very important point for what follows is that there was a decline between what geneticists call a decline between the South and the North in terms of the prevalence of these Indo-European genes. In the South of Europe, it's dominated or about much more common to find genes deriving from these early farmers, which who come from the Middle East. They were farming groups. They were much more clannish. As the Middle East is still today, I regard the Middle East as sort of ethnocentrism, clanism central. They came into Europe about 8500 BC, so way before the Indo-Europeans. And they came in from what is now Turkey, from Anatolia. They came up through Greece and southern Europe. And they headed north, and they really displaced the hunter-gatherers in those areas with some merging. If you go, for example, you go to Sardinia, it's like 95% farmer ancestry. And you know, it's amazing to see that. I mean, within Europe, you see these important genetic lines that really date back thousands of years that have been preserved within Europe. It's an amazing thing. But as they went north, they displaced the hunter-gatherers, as they say, but not completely. There was some merging and interbreeding. But when they got to Scandinavia, they really were halted for like 3,000 years. Farming did not spread north to Scandinavia. And despite the fact that the soil was fertile and all that. And that's because you had a very vibrant hunter-gatherer culture there that was able to hold them off. And it was a complex hunter-gatherer culture. It was not, when you think of hunter-gatherer cultures in anthropology, I always did until very recently, did some reading. You think of hunter-gatherer bands as just small family groupings, you know. But these were complex societies where they were able to have, you know, large populations of people gathering at certain time points of the year. And so these people were able to put up a military defense and keep these people out of there. And that footnote in chapter 4 that I mentioned with talking about Gambutus's work, she mentions, I found a historian of Sweden who is saying that the old gods of Sweden were tended to be female, whereas these new gods coming in with Thor and Odin.
Male. Yeah, it's like two divisions. It's the Vanir is the first classification, which probably actually belonged to the previous, the hunter-gatherers. Which, as you say, has more of it's more nature and magic and kind of like more, you know, some more female traits. And then this new one comes in, the Aesir, which is, of course, the warrior kings and this kind of stuff, you know.
Exactly. And, yeah. and they talk about, you know, there's this mythological battle in Norse mythology between the Aesir and the Vanir.
Yeah.
And the Aesir, I believe, are the sort of warlike male oriented people. And the Vanir are the female-oriented people, or say the other way around, I forget. Anyway, the point is they had a huge battle, and I'm just speculating here, but you know, this may have actually taken place because these people held off the farmers for 3,000 years. They were not easy to overcome, and the result then was a sort of a syncretism between the cultures. In Scandinavia, dominated by the Indo-Europeans, no question about it. I mean, this was a Norse culture.
And that's in the record. That's in the Norse sagas and the mythology, too, the Aesir-Vanir War, huge one. And it was like, you know, again, a new order kind of arose of that, of a kind of a merger of the two. And that's why most of the Scandinavian populations today have a bigger genetic heritage from that previous, right, the hunter-gatherer, so...
Yeah, so as you go north in Europe, you see more genes from the Indo-Europeans, but also more from hunter-gatherers.
Yeah.
There, and so that's that sort of blending that we see in northern Europe, which is, yeah, I think, really responsible for their unique profile.
Very interesting. Okay, a lot of things we could break down and talk about that. It's just so fascinating. But I guess quickly, I just want to show these two books as well. Actually, let me go to that angle right here. Because you do reference Ricardo Duchesne's work, yeah, the uniqueness of Western civilization, right there. And he bases some of that, or he references this book too, Horse, the Wheel, and Language by David W. Anthony. Excellent terrific works, book. Both of these, Kevin.
Terrific book. And of course, Ricardo's really on board with our worldview. Sure. And I assume he's been on Red Ice.
Many
right?
times. Yeah, I definitely have to have him back. But here's the copy of that. Pick up a copy of that, guys, if you can, because it's excellent.
Yeah, he's terrific. And, you know, he just retired from his position at the university under a lot of pressure. And but he's doing okay, and I'm happy to say that. And then this is a terrific book by David Anthony.
Yes.
At a small university somewhere in New York, upstate New York, I think. But this is a terrific book published by Princeton University Press, I believe. I felt they couldn't even find anything more interesting on the Europeans than this thing. This was an exhaustive, just well-done book.
Yeah, definitely. I was showing, actually, there's some... There's a lot of components to what you talked about with that civilization in Turkey and stuff. Some of the oldest records is from a site called Göbekli Tepe. New finds was a German Schmidt. I forget his name. I actually had him on the show. This guy right here talking about the finds that they did here and the fact that the site might have been covered up and stuff. But they're fascinating things because we don't, you know, they're trying to find the origin point of these people and why were they so different? What was... You know, how did this arise? It's very strange. We don't know. I mean, that's just the end of it right now. We have some theories, but we don't know what they arose from, why they had the different religious, mindset and stuff like that. But there's these sites here. You can see the carvings on the stones and stuff. It's just magnificent, you know?
Wow. Yeah, terrific.
All right. So talk to us a little bit about Rome. Rome is a particular interest, of course, interesting in Indo-European culture as well. You make a big point how open Roman culture was to incorporate new peoples and gradually giving rights as well to plebeians. Tell us a bit about this.
Yeah, Rome is incredibly open, and I think that's a characteristic of Western culture in general. And it really was part of their, I call it a group evolutionary strategy, really. They didn't try to exterminate people. But they didn't try to sort of permanently subjugate them either. They would allow their conquered people to eventually become incorporated in general. The people who were at the top of those societies oftentimes just sort of transferred to top positions in Roman society within a few years or a generation. So they would become members of the Senate or things like that. They would be, And what the benefit for Rome was that it expanded their armies. Yeah, they could never have conquered as much as they did, with the small population that they had. When they conquered a people, they incorporated them into their military and made them, you know, have a stake in the system. And they became citizens really, and gradually. When they conquered around Rome and then all of Italy, and they gradually made all those people citizens. And within Rome, there was, the patricians and the plebeians, fought for their rights and they were granted over time. You know, they struck down laws against intermarriage between the two. They struck down laws that plebeians couldn't be, they couldn't assume the office of consul, which is the top military office. And so for a long time, you had to have one patrician and one plebeian. This was during the Republic, which was the period basically prior to the birth of Christ around there, 0 BC. But it was a gradual shift so that they obtained more political power and then more and more peoples were incorporated into the system. Ultimately, though, I mean, what happened, they were so successful, and then they just brought in so many slaves and so many other peoples when they got outside of Italy into the Middle East. They were conquering North Africa. They were conquering all these people that really were not European at all. And then they were bringing them to Rome, and the original Roman population just really died out. Part of that was low fertility. These families that began in the Roman Republic, many, many times died out. They were replaced then by other peoples. And by really the first, second century BC, this was not the same people anymore. It's sort of like what we're doing, only, you know, against our best judgment in terms of what the West is doing now. We're importing all these new people. Do you seriously think we can maintain our civilization as it was with a different set of people? It's ridiculous on the face of it. The early Romans were incredibly virtuous people. They were hardworking, disciplined. They had a strong military ethic, like all the Indo-European cultures. Prestige was to be in the military. And that was really the only way to have any prestige in Roman society for a long time. They looked down on merchants and traders and all that. But that changed. Again, that changed gradually. They became more money oriented and all that. It was a gradual corruption, really, of Roman culture, and the original people died out. Yeah. It was what I call a failed group evolutionary strategy. It was too inclusive by far. And they didn't have a sense of their own boundaries. I've got this speech by Emperor Claudius early in the empire, not too, I think it was first century. And he talks, the question before the Senate is whether they should incorporate the people of Gaul and make them citizens. And Claudius is in favor of it. And he talks about his family, you know, started out as one of these from a people that had been conquered. And then he had risen. And now he was the emperor. And, and he wanted to extend that to everybody. And that was sort of the sort of logic. And of course, Claudius being the emperor, his view won the day. And in 212 AD, they extended citizenship to everybody, the entire empire. That meant North Africa, the Middle East, everywhere. Mm. It was a different country. It was a different culture by then, just completely different.
I wonder what they thought, if they thought that they could just kind of assimilate these people into their culture and turn them into Romans. And again, the parallels today are, of course, staggering in that regard. Or if they had some sense of, you know, us and them at that point. I don't know. I mean, their success, as far as I understand it anyway, was that it was a administrative success, right? I think one of the earlier guys that kind of, well, considered the founder of the Roman Empire was a Pelasgian, from the Pelasgian culture, and he was a surveyor. One of the biggest things that they did was surveying. It was a statistics, data, gather as much as you can and then work with what you can. And then you should take over one area, you convert them, and then you use them against your enemies, right? It was a completely new way of doing things.
The speech by Emperor Claudius said exactly that about assimilation, that these people will become good citizens and they will help us and they will become members of the Senate and all of that. It was a very, optimistic view of incorporating other peoples. But again, that had been characteristic from the beginning. But again, it wouldn't have much mattered if they were just conquering people around Rome, the various Latin peoples, if they'd gone all through Italy, which is incredible. It took them a long time to conquer Italy because Italy was just a whole bunch of these formidable military organizations, really.
Is this like Vandals and Lombards? That's a bit later, is it? Yeah, that's later.
I talk about the history of the Republic. I talk a lot about it in the Independence of Chapter 2, but these different groups around Italy in the prehistoric times, they had to conquer every one of them, and it was never easy. And there were a couple that Veii were particularly difficult.
The Veni, yeah, I remember the reading something about them, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was not easy any step of the way, but they basically went to war every year. And one of the interesting things that you see, they would have all these excuses and that, you know, they were going to protect somebody or something. You know, it was very much, just all these rationalizations, but it was all about, we're going to war, find some reason to go to war every year, basically.
I guess it's like America to a certain extent, right? The foreign wars, yeah. And there's always like some...
Yeah, and the sad thing is that the media, which now controlled by you know who and what they're up to, but now they appeal to that tradition, don't they? They appeal to the military tradition, and like so many Southerners are very much into the military, and then they enlist, and they end up getting maimed in Iraq or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, so sad to see it.
It's crazy, Kevin. But so ultimately, the success then that they did have was to utilize this expansion as something new too. Of course, they did have challenges. They had I think one of the biggest defeats, of course, is when they try to conquer the Germanic people, and that the Battle of Teutoburg, and that significant, very interesting. There's a whole history here which is fascinating, which we could talk a lot about. But so they couldn't actually expand further north. Which is, of course, interesting because of that genetic legacy, too, when you actually go to Germania and further up to Scandinavia. And that could be one of the reasons why they have been so fairly untouched, if I can put it that way, because the Romans didn't get there. But as you say, then it was so diluted because of the success eventually that ultimately was the cause and the root of why they fell apart and collapsed. And right. That opened up, of course, to being invaded by other, other groups and tribes later on, right?
Particularly the Germanic groups.
Yeah.
They conquered the Western Empire. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And of course, they were European and had very strong military traditions of their own.
Absolutely. Again, I mean, the root is the same of these people.
Yeah.
I mean, and also if you look at the statues and stuff in Greece, and I mean, it's clear that it's not the same people there today that was back there then. I mean, they look differently, obviously. So.
Very true.
Yeah.
And when they're same with Rome, you look at those statues from the Republic. I mean, this was a different people.
Yeah, absolutely. So the basic aspects of the book is the chapter on family structure. How does variation in family structure within Western Europe correspond to genetic differences between Northwestern and Southern Europeans or Southern?
Yeah, Europe? Like I was saying before, that one of the big findings I emphasized in the first chapter on population genetics is that you have this north-south genetic climb, with hunter-gatherer and Indo-European genes more common in the north, the farmer genes more common in the south, and you see that reflected in family structure, amazing to say, that has persisted all these centuries into the present. And I focus especially on the divide in France, between a line, sort of the middle of France, dividing south and north. North of that, you have much more of this Northern European culture, and they have very different family structure, much more individualistic. That means that families are sort of separated from their kinship group. They basically have to fend for themselves. And that means individuals have to decide who to marry, that their marriage is not imposed by their parents. Their marriage is not imposed by the kinship group. They can't depend on their wider kinship group much. They can't get married until they have an economic viability, mutual consent of spouses in a monogamous kind of situation. And whereas in the South, it's much more clannish. You have these family groupings that have more than one, several brothers who live together. And they'll be in a sort of a clan type situation where the family as a whole owns the land, and you can't separate from it very well. So it's a very different ball game, and it's much even today in the southern part of France, the children will stay with their birth family much longer, whereas in the north, if they go out and fend for themselves, there's more social support in the south. In the north, again, you have to sort of fend for yourself. And, parents in the north would have to make contracts with their children to make sure that they were taken care of in old age. They'd have to have a contract that stipulated, we have a room, in this house when after we retire. You're going to take over the land. You're going to farm it as our son. But we get to have a place to stay. Well, that would never happen in Southern Europe, where it was just assumed parents would live with the children, and it would be all one big extended family living under the same roof or closely living right together. So very different, much more collectivist way of life. And if you go north to Scandinavia, it's an even more extreme. So really, there are three great nations of family structure within Europe. In the south, much more collectivist, more extended kinship-oriented. The exception there is within Italy. If you go look at the northern part of Italy, it was settled by the Lombards, you mentioned
yes.
before.
Yeah,
and they were Germanic, and they were
yep.
more like typical individualistic family structure that you see in other Germanic peoples.
Yeah.
But southern Italy, not so much. It's much more collectivist. But if you go to Scandinavia, it's the most extreme individualist culture.
And then yet collectivist at the same time with conformity and these kinds of things.
And that's the thing. That bothered me for a long time. How can it be? I have a lot on it in
yeah.
chapter four and in chapter eight.
Yeah.
I think ultimately that are the origin of extreme political correctness that we've seen in Scandinavia. But, and there is a, you know, I have a section in chapter four, the state-sponsored, sort of state-sponsored individualism. And what they mean by that is you provide social supports like healthcare in order to free the individual from any obligations to anybody. In other words, you make divorce easy. You make children independent of parents. You make parents independent of children. So, you know, children don't have to support parents. Parents don't have only really, they have responsibilities for children, but they children have rights against their parents. And there's much just individualism taken to an extreme, but it's supported by the state, mandating things like, you know, health care and welfare payments and all of that. So if a woman doesn't want to stay married, she can raise a child singly, and get supported. And that's individualist because then she can pursue her own wants. The man can pursue his own wants, that sort of thing.
That's why you see this madness with the blurring of the sexes now as well, because we're all just individuals. We could be anything, but collectively we're just like just an individual and all that. But it should be prefaced too that, at least as far as I'm concerned, I mean that's there might be some root in the past, and there could be some genetic legacy or something that has enabled all of this. And feel free to comment on that too. But I think that's a later phenomena, Kevin, with all this this level of like the state becoming the parent essentially, and all their subjects is like their children. I mean if you go back to Viking society, it wasn't like that. I mean, sure you had tribes, but it was like they all lived together. There was long houses, very communal. It was very and that's that transformation has happened with the ascent of Christianity, then into Protestantism, and then into like the Cultural Revolution of the 60s. That's how I see it anyway.
That's right, right. In other words, when this hit in Scandinavia, it took a different turn a little bit. But you see the same trends elsewhere in Western cultures, obviously. But it's a phenomenon in more recent times. This has not happened in Norse times, certainly. This is the only way I can make sense of it. Is in terms of radical individual. But, you know, that was part of the 17th century, the big part of it, central part of it, was egalitarian individualism that came to the fore. And I think that was on very fertile ground in Scandinavia.
So is there, because we didn't use that term earlier when we talked about, you know, Indo-Europeans and Duchesne's work and stuff like that, but this idea of the aristocratic individualism, I mean, it's a little bit different because that sense was like there's a king, a chieftain, a leader, and that was like, you know, the individual, and there was like a whole society kind of around the maybe not protection of that individual, but they were like the leader of the pack or whatever. But is there a reason then that the Indo-European legacy is strong in this region, and then now later on that this individualism, particular individualism that we see in Scandinavia, is there a link in any way between those two as far as you are concerned?
Yeah, about aristocratic individualism, we should mention that a little bit. You know, it wasn't like it was a despotic situation where one guy rules other people. It was a sort of egalitarianism among peers, you know, so that the king or the leader was the first among equals, and he would consult them, but there would be all this reciprocity. I mean, if you're going to be a military leader among the Indo-Europeans or the Germanic or the Norse, you had to give gifts to the people that were following you. You had to recompense them. It wasn't a matter of despotism and forcing these people to follow you or something like that. They had to be incentivized. It was a free market system. And so it really was an egalitarianism among this group, this aristocratic group. But egalitarian individualism is different. And that it's egalitarian, period. You know, it's not, and so you, there's been a tendency since the 17th century to sort of level, to have lower social class differences and to, much more egalitarian, period. Scandinavian societies, by the way, always tend to be very, relatively egalitarian. The thing there, I mean, this is, the sort of parliament.
And that's early. I mean, that's in the record, Kevin. Yeah. That in terms of like what other societies had at that time was not at all. This was actually, I mean, yes, you had a leader, you had a chieftain and all that stuff, but you had people, representatives from all the different tribes and the families that gathered. And that's why you see even these large stone works that you see in Scandinavia with the, they all represented one family or one tribe, et cetera. And they came there and they did agreements. It was a political assembly, essentially, as you say.
Yeah. And that's the interesting thing that whereas the Germanic peoples, like in Germany and Northern Europe, they subjugated these people and into making them serfs, basically. I mean, that was really the feudal system, right? That did not happen in Scandinavia. There was much more representation. Peasants were never serfs in Scandinavia.
You had thralls, but that was a smaller group, I believe, right?
What do you mean?
Thralls was what they called it, but that was like, that was a smaller group. Yeah. It was not, as you say, it was not a feudal system in that sense. They did have slaves, obviously, but it was like it was a special kind of branch. It was not just the rest of the people, you know what I mean?
Oh, no, but they had a representation in the parliament.
Yeah.
And they had some political power. I cite these historians and say that these people were the freest, commoners, as it were, in Europe at the time, by far. And they never were really subjugated in the same way that even the Germanic people subjugated their people into this feudal system. There was just this long tradition up there of relative freedom and individualism. I think that it makes it different. It's a different culture area. And again, it has to be separated from the rest of Europe in a lot of ways. Certainly from the south of Europe, but also I think from the Germanic peoples in general.
Interesting. Yeah. Showing some of these rock, stone ships, as they call them, and stuff like that too. You see these all scattered all over, but there's plenty in France and stuff like that too. Now let's move on a little bit and spend a couple of minutes and then we'll take a break from the first part. Kevin, I'll continue at the members' website for part two. But tell us a little bit about, the Catholic Church, the legacy there, and then, of course, the move over into Protestantism, because that's another major revolution. This altered and shifted and changed so many things as well.
Yeah, I have a whole chapter on the Catholic Church. My view is that Roman culture per se really had very little influence, in a way, on European and later European culture, because they essentially became a different people. But their legacy was the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church did play an important role. I suppose it still does to a certain extent, but it played a very important role in European history. It started out in the Roman Empire, appealed to the lower classes, a lot of it, it was incredibly anti-Jewish. I discussed that in my book, Separation of Discontents. I have a whole chapter on that. And it was very collectivist from the beginning, and it wanted political power. I mean, because it really was a sort of a political interest group. I mean, they wanted to prevent Jews from enslaving Christians. They wanted to, expand the rights of Christians and the lower classes generally. And so they were always trying to achieve political power and influence with the emperor. And I think that was the legacy of the church. And there's a long history of that going back to the Roman times. But in the Middle Ages, the church, continued. They were important for sort of keeping civilization alive during the early Middle Ages. What remained of Roman civilization. But the church gradually became sort of sort of an arm of the aristocracy, and there's a lot of corruption. I mean, if you had this nobleman, this feudal lord, and he would make his brother into the bishop, and the bishop would have a bunch of concubines, you know, and there would be all this real corruption going on. But a very important thing that happened then was the papal revolution, where essentially there was a reformation within the church in the 11th, 12th century, where the church really lived up to its Christian ideals, and the clergy, they insisted that the clergy be celibate. They got rid of all this favoritism to nepotism going, that was going on. Simony, where people would buy offices in public offices and so on in the church. Selling indulgence. All these things were happening. But then during the 11th, 12th century, you had this papal revolution where it was led by monks, and they were, they were really sincere Christians, believed in it totally. And, they, reformed the church so that it lived up to its ideals, its Christian ideals, lived up to the ideal of celibacy, lived up to the ideal of, being a pure religious, motivations, where they weren't interested in money. And so you had these mendicant friars. I mean, I went to school for 12 years with the Dominicans, and then the Christian Brothers. And these are Dominicans were a preaching order. They would go out. St. Thomas Aquinas famously was a Dominican. And I learned a lot about that in Catholic school. And they really became popular with the people. And they exhibited for the public image of the church at the time was that they were altruistic. I mean, these were men who were eschewing sex, were eschewing marriage, they were eschewing wealth, they were eschewing everything in the name of God, and doing the right thing, and heavenly rewards. And this was the image of the church, and it was very popular among the people. And this was, so then the church used this image to attain power within the society. They used this image to threaten emperors, kings. If a king wanted to get divorced, if a king wanted to have a concubine or make his bastard child into an heir or something like that, the church would prevent that. And the weapon they had was, if you do this, we will set your people against you. We will excommunicate you. And if you are excommunicated, your people will not follow you. They will not want to pay their taxes. They'll want to rebel against you. And so kings were intimidated by this, and rightly so. And the church had an awful lot of power, but it was this moral power. They had achieved a sort of a moral community within the Middle Ages, that a Christian moral community that really expanded through all of Europe, into Scandinavia, down through Italy, and then after, Spain. After the Reconquista. And so it was a pervasive sense of sort of pan-European culture that we haven't had ever since. There was one culture there, of Christendom. And it really struck me that one of the things when the Normans invaded England, after a while, the king, said something bad about Thomas of Becket. I wish I could get rid of Thomas of Becket, the Archbishop of Canterbury. Hmm. And so his men went off and killed him. Well, this was a scandal through all of Europe. It wasn't just England. It was through all Europe, because this Christian prelate had been brutally murdered at the whim of a king. This was something you could not do.
Yeah. There's a lot to say there, of course, Kevin. We're going to continue to break that down. He was talking about the Reformation later on, too, and kind of how that reshaped things, and that we'll kind of work our way up towards the 60s. There's just time to break down there. So obviously we've just scraped the surface here. But I want ladies and gentlemen out there to check out a copy, of course, of the book, and getting the book as well. I'm going to put up the Amazon. I had the Amazon link here as well. Is Amazon the best place to get a copy, Kevin?
It's the only place.
It's the only place. All right, gotcha. Yep, so there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Individualism and the Western Liberal Tradition, Evolutionary Origins, History, and Prospects for the Future as well. And, of course, I want to ask you a bit more about the future later as well. There is a Kindle version available too?
Yes, there is. Page you were showing, it shows the Kindle right next to it.
Yeah, it is right there, isn't it? Yeah, there you go. So there's a Kindle version. Great. Yeah, definitely check that out, folks. There's a lot of good things here that Kevin has been working on for years and years, and theories. And I remember, Kevin, we've talked about this kind of on and off, really, for many years as you've come and gone and been a guest on the show, of just like the difference in overall, of course, Europeans and their altruism and these kinds of things, and the influence, of course, from the more Northern Germanic people and stuff like that. So is this kind of do you feel that this is the book that's encapsulated a lot of that and a lot of that kind of research that you've done over the years?
Well, yeah, this is in a sense sort of my life's work, and it incorporates everything, including my work on the Jews in the last part of chapter 6 and then chapter 9. So it sort of puts it all together in a way.
Wonderful. Yeah, absolutely. Excellent. So guys and gals out there, pick up a copy. It was released just here September 13, 2009. It says it's a number one bestseller in Scandinavian history here. So that's good.
Yeah, right.
If that's true. Yeah. Has it been selling okay as far as you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm very happy with it.
Nice. Perfect. Really. Perfect.
Because, it's not uncommon for, especially for an academic type book. They're going to be like 3 million after something like that. It's good. It's very good.
Excellent. Yeah, and I definitely want to make sure we plug that as well here, guys, and that you get a copy if you want to read more about this and Kevin's fascinating work. Then, of course, let's talk about some of your other stuff out there as well. Tell us a bit about the OccidentalObserver.net, Kevin, and the Occidental Quarterly as well. Tell us about that.
Okay. You want me to talk about it now?
So yeah. Give a little plug for it.
I'm still. But one of the reasons it took me so long is I have focused on other things. I edit the Occidental Observer, and we have an article every couple days or sometimes every day. The Occidental Quarterly is a scholarly journal, and I just really wish people would subscribe to it. We're under a lot of pressure. It is an academic-type journal, it may not be for everybody, but it's something that everybody should support, because this is important to have this, to have a scholarly kind of magazine out there that really presents these ideas in a high-flown kind of way, that well-researched kind of way, really and honestly, without that, I think that's one thing that we've been missing, and one of the big weapons that our enemies have. They control all the high culture. They control the universities. They control the big book review things, New York Times Book Review and all that. So we don't have much, and we should support what we have. And, of course, Red Ice is something also worth supporting. Everybody has to really find things that they want to support. This does not cost much. Occidental Quarterly costs only $30 a year for the electronic version, $60 a year for U.S. Subscription. So this is something anybody really can afford. We appreciate people doing that, because we're under a lot of pressure. We've been deplatformed like everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. It's very, very important. A lot of people, of course, are struggling in terms of getting out there, being heard, and it's deplatforming and shadow banning and everything else. But again, this is one way that they can't prevent you yet in any way of getting an actual copy in the mail, of a journal. So that's what you get there, people. A lot of good articles in the Occidental Quarterly, Journal of Western Perspectives on Man, Culture, and Politics. A lot of good things. So 4 times a year, definitely check it out. It's TOQ online for the Occidental Quarterly online.com. That's the website for that. But of course, you can find links from the OccidentalObserver.net as well. And then make sure you subscribe to or follow Kevin on Twitter. TOO Edit is his handle over there, or just search for Kevin MacDonald. Anything else we want to plug before we wrap up for the first segment here, Kevin?
That's about it, Henry, and looking forward to the next thing.
All right, great. So, guys, stay with me here, Kevin. Join us over at redicemembers.com. Of course, a subscription. You get access to all the things that we've done over the years back to 2006. We have hundreds and hundreds of hours over there. You get access to Weekend Warrior exclusive videos and all that good kind of stuff as well. But thank you so much for tuning in, for watching the first part. We'll wrap up right now. But again, join us over at redicemembers.com. We'll be back with Kevin McDonald with much more. See you over there.